Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Modern. I'm your host, Pipsqueak, and I'm joined by Simon and Dodger. This week, but we don't do this on a weekly enough basis. This episode, we're going to be talking about a topic that might be a little bit negative. So if you're not looking for that sort of thing in your life right now, maybe this isn't the episode for you. But we're going to be talking about cards that we hate. And we deliberately did not have a very specific rule for these. This was very much about meant to be open-ended, whether it's you hate a design or you hate how it plays, or just it really bothers you in some really minuscule way. I know at one point there was a card I had briefly that was on here for art reasons, but that got cut. If you designed these cards, it's okay. We still like your cards in general, but, you know, everyone has pet peeves, and these are ours. So without further ado, we've all ranked our hatreds going least most mild to most intense. So, Dodger, why don't you start us off with your most mild card?
Okay. So this is one that I don't feel incredibly strongly about compared to some of the other ones on this list, but I thought that I still wanted to include it. And I think the card that I want to talk about first is actually Whisperwood Exploration. And my reasoning is pretty simple. I think the card is simply too efficient for what it offers. And I think it pushes out a lot of more interesting impulse effects that might be run in control decks otherwise. Because it is simply like the best impulse effect ever, because it can also be a regrowth. And it's also pretty much the best regrowth effect ever. So I just think that like it has a bit of a negative impact on like what other kinds of cards can see play. And I also think it's a little like, I guess that's pretty much it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's mostly reasonable. I don't think as a control deck, I would play much in the way of impulse effects to begin with in this format. Just like there's not that much of a need to. But as far as regrowths go, yeah, that's pretty fair.
I just strongly agree. As much as I like playing regrowths, that's kind of why I hate this. If you compare this to like Grizzly Salvage or like the fact that it's an instant at the same time, if you're black and green and not running Whisperwoods, there's a solid chance you're just wrong. The only exception is if you have an aggro plan. Like, if you're combo, regrowing stuff is amazing. If you're control, the options it offers you at such a low cost is unparalleled.
I also think another point that I wanted to add, I think that the card is very fun to play with, but I think that it can be very difficult to play against if you know your opponent has it in their deck, because if the game goes long and your opponent is operating mostly instant speed, you're going to have to play with the potential knowledge that they could Whisperwood any card in their graveyard back and then immediately cast it. Which can kind of like put a kind of a stifling effect on what you can do in a game, especially in some kind of control or mid-range mirror.
One thing that does really bother me about this is it pushed out a card that I think is a genuinely cool design, which is Wealth of the Underbrush, which is very similar. It's a sorcery for green and black. You mill 5, then return a permanent card from your graveyard to your hand. And the deck building restrictions involved with it being a sorcery and with it only grabbing permanent cards just fundamentally changed what decks could run it. And that card was incredibly exciting and hype in the Villainy Hunter's Hideout deck I played for a bit. But I think kind of the... I would never want Whisperwood's Exploration to change because it's not a card that necessitates change. But at the same time, I think it does something... It does a much more mild version of what Lightning Bolt does to other burn spells.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it.
I think what really got to me when I was deck building one time, one thing that I dislike about actual factual regrowth is that It's the best way to recur spells by a mile. And Whisperwoods has this in fucking spades. Being an instant again is so huge for that. There's no reason to look at cards that, like blue cards that recur things when you have Whisperwoods. It pushes out recursion on so many axes.
Cool. Well, it seems like we're mostly in agreement about this one.
All right, Simon, you go with yours.
Yeah. Impumo. I was going to say other Flame Tongue Kavu Chupacabra-esque walkers that come down and kill a creature like Mafua and Lucian, but really it's just Impumo. The amount of times that locks out a creature deck, while still being a pretty on-rate way to kill X1s or exile creatures, is ridiculous.
I think that's a reasonable take. Mm-hmm. I think like there are certainly matchups where Mpumo doesn't really do much, but there are also matchups where, as you said, he can essentially lock a player out of the game if they're not already established on the board. And very cheaply, too, while still being just like a good removal spell. So I think in general, I agree with everything you said, Simon.
The whack thing to me is Mpumo has been in this format for close to 2 years now, and one toughness creatures still get a lot of play. And I feel like if we were doing a really good job of maximizing just the most busted cards in the format, Mpumo would be one of those cards that just kind of pushed X1s out of the format. Very similar to like how for a hot sec Liliana Last Hope just dunked on D&T to the point where it wasn't that playable in Legacy. And Mpumo doesn't have the drawback of, oh yeah, but what if their creature has more than one toughness, because you can just say, cool, exile it. That's not my problem anymore. I don't need to worry about that.
Yeah, like if your opponent is two creatures, but it's like a 3/3 and a 3/1, Mpumo is amazing. You kill the 3/1 by plus one-ing, and they can't kill Mpumo with other creature on board. So you still get a turn to draw, to cast a kill spell on it or play a creature to protect him. There are surprisingly few board states where you ever feel punished for Mpumo. And in creature matchups, the floor is always a 3-mana kill spell that they have to do something about afterward.
Yeah.
That is a ridiculous floor.
The one thing that I would also note about Mpumo, which is kind of strike against him, is he's one of the least fun walkers to play, because he's so unsplashy. Like, if you're not, like, just massacring your opponent with a plus one, it's just like, I'm going to ping you for one. I'm going to ping you for one. I'm going to destroy four of your lands. Wait, what? And it's like, that is the most unexciting play pattern of any of the playable walkers in this format. And I think that's a kind of a shot against him, where, unlike Whisperwood's Exploration, where we're talking about, like, yeah, but at least it's fun to play, though, it's Mpumo isn't, like, not that fun to play. He's good. If you like playing powerful cards, he's still, you know, unobjectionably powerful. But there's nothing exciting about casting and activating an Mpumo.
This is also the only card on my list that I have only been on one side of. I have only been on the good end of Mpumo. I've never been on the business end of his loyalty abilities. I just don't like playing him. He makes playing against creature decks uninteresting in a way that other walkers, other kill spells, or board wipes do not.
Yeah, I think the point that also I just want to emphasize is Pip's point about the ultimate. Like, the ultimate is not interesting. Like, very, very few times does it actually lead to anything other than kill three of your lands.
Yeah, you just choose four lands.
Yeah. And, like, it doesn't even destroy enough lands to make the control deck scoop. They're just like, wow, that's unfortunate.
That was a triple stone rain. Am I still in it? And the answer is usually no, but, like, maybe? So you gotta keep playing.
Oh, I hate those situations.
And I can't even destroy heart.
Yeah.
My elite.
That's the thing.
Or Nereba.
You choose the lands, so you can't even snipe utility lands unless they have multiple utility lands.
I would say like the least fun situation to be in a game of Magic the Gathering is I am 95% to lose this game, but I have to keep playing because of that 5%. Like that, yeah. So anyway.
All right, so my mildest one is Conspiracy of Ravens, which is a card that doesn't see that much play, but one, it feels so fucking clunky to play with. Like, every time I have willingly put a Conspiracy of Ravens in my deck and used it, I just, it ends up leaving just this, like, taste of dust in my mouth. It doesn't play like one mana hand attack should on the, like, offensive. But on the receiving end, like, it's kind of a toss-up. Like, you never have those circumstances where your opponent, like, is on the play in turn one Thoughtseize and just totally fucks up your day. But, like, on the other hand, if you're a slower deck, it still does the exact same thing as Thoughtseize. And the fact it has these neat synergies with being an enchantment means people are vastly more likely to put into their deck, and also the unconditional nature of it makes people evaluate it over cards like Duress or Stolen Secrets that I think are actually just better than it. Because I think people don't realize how often a one-turn delay on your hand attack takes your hand attack spell from, like, fine to actually unplayable.
But Pip, I can get it back with Wealth of the Underbrush.
Yeah, the thing that I've mostly seen it with is in these, like, you know, white-black X enchantment control decks that want to, like, loop things with Reflect on Serenity. And it's like, you can't profitably loop it. Like, looping hand attack doesn't really work because your opponent can just play out their cards.
I still think the fact that it triggers Corporate War...
Chile would like a word with you.
Yeah, maybe.
Is, like, a potential point in its favor. I don't think it's totally unplayable, but I actually think by far the worst part about it is that your opponent knows it's coming, so oftentimes they can just play their card that they don't want to get discarded, you know?
Yep.
And you often lose the advantage of having a discard spell on the play, as Pip said, just to expand on that. The analogy I would like to use is people often, like, I guess if I ask you the question, which is worse, mulligan on the play or mulligan on the draw, right? The answer is actually mulliganing on the draw, because you lose any advantage, right? You don't have the tempo advantage. You don't have the card advantage. If you mulligan on the play, you at least have the tempo advantage. Conspiracy of Ravens, you're giving up essentially, you're giving up a free tempo advantage. So the discard spell is both worse on the play and on the draw, but it's exponentially worse on the play because you're giving up the advantage of having a discard spell on the play. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I agree with that. And
I gotta make a case for Conspiracy here. I do think it's overplayed, but I think it does have its home. I legitimately think if you're using it as a resource to make it less of a dead card late, like with Corporate War, that's absolutely really
powerful.
I agree
with that, Simon.
I think Legend Weaving, it's a really nice one of. I think 3-mana hand attack is really important in some matchups for Legend Weaving decks. Notably, Weaving isn't.
But that doesn't actually matter that much because, it won't.
It means they can't return.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. I still think the fact that it's delayed means you don't really want it in those decks because it's pretty bad to cast, and you do still draw it some percentage of the time.
My thing is specifically with Legend Weaving too. Those decks have the most trouble with the slow control decks, in my opinion. And that's where having that mode can be.
I agree with you on your point about Corporate War, though. I think it could definitely be playable in a Corporate War deck.
The one thing that I think MSCM players, and this to some extent includes myself, need to get a little bit better at is realizing that it's okay for your answers to not be unconditional as long as they're always good when they work. And I think Conspiracy of Ravens is one of those things where the decision to play that over Duress or over stolen secrets is basically saying, I'm not willing to take the risk and play the more powerful card because I would rather play the card that, like, has more problems but is, you know, ye old and reliable.
You can sort of use a similar analogy of Pithwilt versus Demonworthy. Like, Abzan decks will often play 4 Pithwilts and only 3 Demonworthies, right? Or something like that.
I think 2 mana versus 3 mana is too big of a difference.
Yeah, that's fair.
But in general, running Vindicates versus Paths, you can kind of compare. Maybe not MSAM specifically, but I have seen people run unconditional removal like Vindicates, where they should be running Bolts or Paths.
The other thing that I'll note in terms of this, like, kind of conditional nature question is, some of this is obviously coming from the decks that you can choose to play, but a lot of the cards that you're most concerned about, the matchups where you want hand attack the most, are the matchups where Duress shines. Like,
Definitely. The
need to, you know, take creatures is a very small percentage of the Duress matchups, with the possible exception being if you're a combo deck and you're looking to play it in order to, like, strip your opponent of Hate Bears. But even then, like, I think you just kind of take those beatings and just say, well, whatever, if they're on Hate Bears, they're on Hate Bears.
I think something else we're throwing out here is Prying Inquiry also outclasses a fair Conspiracy Absolutely. Of Ravens. Like, Prying Inquiry is the nuts against control.
Insane.
And it's just as slow as Conspiracy, low-key. And I think people miss that when they put it in decks without some sort of synergy like Corporate War.
All right, so Dodger, let's go to your next card.
So my next card is Stand Unassailable. There are multiple reasons why I strongly dislike this card. The most prominent of which is that it makes sideboarding so boring. Like literally, a rule that people often use is just, like, if you're green, like, throw in 4 Stand Unassailable, it'll probably be good. And, like, I think that's very true because of the second point. It's so polarizingly good in the matchups where it's good that, like, of course you would put it in your sideboard, right? Like, given that Burn exists, right, and there are also plenty of other decks that are trying to 100 to zero you very quickly, Stand Unassailable is, like, one of the best ways for control decks to beat those decks, right? And it's like, I don't like this sideboard dynamic where it's like, did you draw your sideboard card? Okay, you win. Did you not? Okay, you probably lose, right? Like, and I think that not only does this have that gameplay, but it also has the problem of pushing out other potential sideboard options. So that's why I'm not a fan of the card.
I think anyone who is putting 4 Stand Unassailables in their sideboard of their green deck, unless they are, like, the hardest control deck in the world, is smoking something. I'm, like, one of the biggest proponents of Stand Unassailable, but I think there are so many green decks where it's just, like, if you're, like, Podlight, for instance, you would never want to run Stand Unassailable. Snowmom is just better. Or
I disagree, really. Actually. I think there's a strong case in Podlight for one of, because you can find it off a council, and the 7-mana mana sink is not irrelevant. The
7-mana mana sink is relevant in every single deck that runs it, and if it isn't, you should not be on it. But, like...
Oh, definitely.
When
Sacrificial
Bull exists, like, that's another major source of life gain that also can be beefy, that also hates graveyards in the process. Like, I think Stand Unassailable is one of those cards that it definitely is a very powerful card. It's one of the two strongest revelations, and you can make a case for it being the strongest. But I think there are so many tools to just shit on life gain. Like, Rage of the Ravage, or sorry, Wish.
It's Rage of the Ravaged.
Like the Kahamba or Dawn.
Rage.
That card could conceivably see more main deck play and burn than it currently does, and just, you feel so stupid when you board in a card that just gains you life instead of impacting the board when your opponent is on that. Like, the thing
I almost made my hate list, by the way.
Yeah. Right. I think in general, Stand on Syllable is just one of those cards where I agree with you that it's polarizing, but the decks that it's polarizing against are decks that kind of invite it. Yeah. It's like complaining that it's like, okay, I definitely don't want MSCM to ever have Rest in Peace or Leyline at the Void. But also, like, the decks that those cards are good against are kind of decks that demand those cards. So it's kind of this weird vicious cycle.
Yeah, I kind of get what you're saying there. I think that's a fair point to make.
I'm going to be a bit of a pedant here and a bit of a contrarian. It's not a polarizing sideboard card that wins when you draw it, because it's a polarizing mainboard card that is just good when you draw it. Not enough people mainboard that card. I am also part of that everybody. I do not mainboard that card enough. It's actually really good against a lot of control decks. It gains so much life. And way more decks hit 7 mana than people think. I'm not saying run 7 drops, but I am saying run 2 drops that draw you 7 drops, like Stand Unassailable. I think that card is actually messed up in the main, but also I think that makes it less swingy than you're describing.
I agree that in general, actually, there are more circumstances that people should be boarding it in that they aren't. Like, in the Team Unified, event, I realized that it was a card that I should be boarding in against most control decks when I was on Assailant Control. Just because gaining 7 life just kind of says, cool, we're going to go into the late game now. And if we're in the late game, this deck is built to beat you. But also, like, looping Stand on Assailables with Whisperwoods Exploration is kind of my guilty pleasure. So Dodger seems like this list is just built to attack.
Oh, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Well,
I mean, the idea for this podcast started from Dodger hating on Veil, right?
Yeah.
The last one. I think that's definitely where Dodger's hate resides, where your love begins.
Let's be honest, it's also vice versa. Which we'll
I think Pip and I are two sides of the same coin.
And that's why it's really important to have someone else here to just kind of balance it all out. Well, less of balance it all out. I think we're actually evenly balanced, but make it less argumentative. Anyway, Simon, what do you hate?
Oh, yeah. My number 3 is, it's a bit of a strange card because it's actually 5 cards. Scion. I do not like this. Okay, so actually, I recently made a tier list of my favorite Titan cycles, like mythic, big mythic creatures. And I put the Scions next to the original Titans in tier 1. None of the others made that. I actually love them. They're so flashy and cool, and why the fuck are they 5 mana? They are 5 goddamn mana, and they are so easy to proc twice in a turn. Like, the turn you play them, and then twice the next turn if you need to. They all have these insane effects that are worth 3+ mana each time you proc them. The white one is a 5/5 that creates a 3/3, and they all have keywords. The black one is a 5/5 with a keyword that reanimates a 3 drop. That is from any graveyard for some reason. That is absurd. The red and green ones are also kind of gross, but they're so much worse than the Esper ones, it's not even funny. The blue one is the best FTK in the format, because it can also lock your opponent out of the game.
It's a lot less offensive than it once was, but I was definitely amused that when you were starting out by the bullshit of them, you didn't even touch the blue one to start.
They are all, the Esper ones especially, but I feel like the red and green ones are just pushed out by Vesper ones, are so offensive as 5 drops, even in the context of MSEM, in my opinion. They are 5 balanced 5 drops, the same way Intrepid was balanced 3 drop.
So, my thought on the Scions, I agree that they're sweet and they're splashy and they do cool things. My issue with this is I think they're just a bit too flashy. And when it comes to, like, this is just my experience. Like I just submitted a set to MCM, right? My experience with designing a 5-drop that's intended for the format is, like, how the fuck do you compete with these cards? Like, it's just so hard. And every time we have a set review, it's like, okay, it's a 5-mana creature, but, like, why would you run this over a Scion? You know, like, almost every single 5-drop, that's what it comes down to. And I think recently, like, the only 5-drop that's seen play besides Scions has been Earthbreaker Behemoth. I could be wrong, but...
And the Earthbreaker's red-green, the worst Scion color.
Siessa in Podlight would be the other one I point to. I also think just mid-range decks, Siessa is really good, partially because she steals Scions. Yeah. So, you know, if it really boils down to it, now you have the Scions.
The amount of times that I have been happy to grab the, like, any of the Scions off of Siessa Tresmond is pretty high.
The thing that I will say is clearly what we should do, if we want to introduce more playable 5-drops to the format, we should revert the nerf that made roll a 6-drop and bring it back down to 5.
You see, I think the Scions compete with roll on 5.
There's no excuse for playing the white Scion over
roll on 5. I mean, the excuse is you're not green.
I think heavily white. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's a good reason. But also, why aren't you in green? Like, come on, it's free. Just splash green.
I mean, you got me there.
But yeah, no, I like what the Scions have done to the format fundamentally, because I think they basically told people, hey, wake up, stupid. Ramp and mid-range are playable. Come on, we're going to go stomp on some people. And I think as the format has kind of matured, it's like sufficiently, there are fast decks, but there are enough decks that kind of want to take their pace that I don't feel like the Scions are like, well, if you're doing that, you have to be doing a Scion thing. But I do think creature-wise, you're going to really struggle. You should probably have Planeswalkers instead in that slot is kind of what I'm getting at. Or Beyond Scions. Those are both options.
I think part of it, I don't know. Like, I think Scions were important on a very specific axis, which is in small formats, sometimes you need a broken card to remind players that something is playable. Like, you need broken 5-drops to remind players that actually we hit 5 mana a lot, and having good 5-mana cards is good. Like, you need something flashy and broken to remind players to actually do that. I think Scions, we see that with aggro a lot, where it's like, no, we've always had good aggro tools. So we just haven't been playing them. I think Scions are that. That's for 5-drops. Awesome.
I remember what it was like to play mid-range decks before the Scions. And so after we nerfed roll, do you know what the next, like, okay, well, this card feels like it invalidates, like, 80% of mid-range threats was? Helvala, Palace of Glory. If you guys don't know what she is...
Unfortunately, I do.
Because that card does mean that your mana setup becomes a 4-4 angel, and that 4-4 angel creates another 4-4 angel the next turn. And, like, it was really hard to catch up in Ardy's Mirrors if your opponent stuck her, partially because she also was indestructible.
Pardon me, once I blame this on Ardy's. When you have so much card velocity, curving out matters less.
And in general, it's one of the reasons why I think MSEM just has some really weird looking tools, because a lot of things I would say were balanced around broken cards, but definitely MSEM was a format that had a lot more broken cards in it before May, and a lot of designers were designing with it in mind. So even if people weren't printing cards that, like, were trying to compete with Ardy's Study, which Hunter's Hideout was meant to be that, I don't think it ever really did its job, but also the card is insanely underplayed. But though, just so many balance and design decisions were just factoring in old Villainy, old Roll, old Ardy's Study, a bunch of cards that are now banned.
Sometimes mana, right? Like with Snowtron and Angel Gush. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, I would never advocate for a Scion nerf, but I also think hatred of them is incredibly understandable. All right, so we're at the one where I call out Dodger now. Bad-looking cards that are actually good if you know how to build decks. So what I'm saying here is there's just this class of cards where whenever people see them, there are two types of people that get exposed to them. The first is people who know what they're doing and who are able to build, like, dumb either combo decks or just really efficient decks with some very strong synergies in them. And the other people are people who think that Magic has been perfected by Sakharov.
That's a very good way to phrase that.
And Polyp Pools and Mechanothurge both fall in that category, where both of those are cards I fundamentally wrote off because every deck I saw people putting them in before competent players got their hands on them was just like, this is absurd. Why are you doing this? This is dumb. Don't do this. Like, I did put Polyp Pools in Blue-Red Dragon Control and also in Grixis Dragons. I think it was defensible there, but some of the synergies people were trying to force with it just didn't make any sense. And I think this GP and this month in general has just shown, oh, there are so many good shells for these types of cards. The issue is just people were building bad shells for these bad shells for bad cards rather than good shells that make bad cards into not being bad cards, basically.
So wait, are the two, like, poster children, like, what are the poster children for this category?
I'm listing Polyp Pools and Mechanothurge. I think Mechanothurge was a really big miss on my part because, you know, Matt pretty much instantly pointed out, or Time Spiral rather, instantly pointed out, hey, there's an infinite combo here. Are we worried? And I was like, well, the infinite combos people are listing involve playing this, then untapping and playing, like, a 3-drop. So, no, we're not actually.
Yeah, I think the deciding factor is more, like, how easily the fast mana package fits into that deck and, like, what that deck wants to do.
Yeah, and Yumi Spheres was a really big find for that archetype, because it's both a card that's fast mana, well, not fast mana, but it's a good mana rock, it's doing something you want to do, and it also is a perfect payoff for this sort of thing.
A Tinker's Choice is also pretty huge. Being an instant speed tutor that also blinks removal is so huge in a combo deck.
On my radar. Unity Spheres and the
Electric. Wait, so my question is...
Any artifact you have on the board is ramp for Unity Spheres. Is ramp for Tinker's Choice. Sorry, is what I would say.
Wait, so my question here is, why is this a call out on me?
That's fair. My basic thought process is, I think there's a defensiveness that sometimes happens, not just you, but also like two or three other people, when I describe cards as bad. And the answer is, I'm shorthanding to, they're bad unless you warp your deck around them, and also I don't think they're worth it. You usually only play warp decks around cards that are worth it, such as Paired Pools and Seeker. But I do think this type of category of cards.
So, verges, like, on the I'll say, I build plenty of decks around shitty cards. Except then I play them and I'm like, oh, this deck's not very good, and then I don't play it in the GP. I think that might be the big difference. I mean, I don't know. Are you about to lay down some disrespect on Chonkord? Because I will not take that. What is bad card that I built that deck?
Yeah, I kind of am. I think Chonkord's ass. I
think that deck is a...
Hello? Did you make the top six? I don't think so.
80% of the deck.
I did.
Yeah, but I can't.
Bad decks can make the top six.
Actually, that's also not true. Bad players make the top eight all the time.
Yeah, bad players do. Okay. I'm not going to name names.
I actually think Chonkord was a very good deck, and everyone who said it's bad has never seen it play.
I think Chonkord is...
Okay, bro, did you even watch
any of... A very good shell.
Like, literally any of them.
Yes. That... This is what I'm basing this on. I thought it was a good deck when I looked at it in the GP list. I was like, oh, wow. That 5-5 haste is kind of scary.
The deck's not even a Seismic Colossus deck. It's an Emissary of Antiquity deck that happens to also have Seismic Colossus in it. Like, I don't know. Okay, so I don't want to derail it too much, but I actually think that deck was very good, and I was a little sad when Wilted Lotus was nerfed, because I think that killed the deck. Although maybe there's a version that runs blue and globe, and you kind of try to do that thing, but also through format Intrepid kind of hurt it. So
I actually
one of the biggest plays in that deck was being able to go turn one Wilted Lotus, turn two Emissary, cast Intrepid.
Yeah,
like that was actually a free win.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds kind of busted. Will not disagree. I think one of the things that really messed me up when it came to Chonkor is I looked at it, and being the player that I am, I was like, oh, cool, this has Ninus here. This must be a Ninus here deck. And then I started, I was like, this is the worst.
I mean, it can be a Ninus here deck. Like, Unceasing Flames goes a long way. It's got the Flames approach.
Trust me, I know in Ninus here, math. That was...
The deck can kill on, like, turn 5. Just burn.
It can't ever be a Ninus here deck.
It's not a slow deck. Ninus here is a decent burn spell that already, like, buffs your...
Ninhir Seer is not a good burn spell.
No, it costs... you're already running 4 Bottle Lightning.
That's fair. And I guess you can't abuse Knack, so Ninhir Seer is probably
better. Flare Blitz was a card that probably should have been in the main. I had it in the sideboard. But I honestly didn't know it existed when I built the main.
Ninhasir being a 5-5 is like stuff for the deck. Like drawing you a creature is non-zero.
So like there's plenty of ways to cast spells.
As consistently abuse the spell copy. As
you can pitch like whatever copy. Like if you have cards in your hand, usually those cards are going to be like Unceasing Flames, Flames Approach. You're happy to discard those cards when you flip Ninhasir.
I mean, I just think a big part of being in this year deck
it's a 5-5 indestructible, and
killing
you really only need to cast one burn spell. They're probably dead.
Indestructible.
Okay, but...
Okay. but yeah, next...
Hey,
I think we've gone a bit off track. I shouldn't have come to Dodgers pride like that.
Hey, if you're going to attack me, at least have something to base it on, you know?
All right, Dodger.
Actually, this is going to be kind of like reboot part two. This entry is basically dedicated to whichever one you think is the more problematic piece of the heart attack combo. So there's some debate. There's some debate. Well, I think like the Heart of Nazina is like obviously the more like egregious of the two, but I also think that Mastery of the Veil is, how do I phrase this? I think it's very poorly thought out what happens when you do have a lot of this mana, just because it scales more ridiculously than like any X spell in canon or custom Magic that I've seen. And I just really don't think it's fun gameplay to just randomly lose the game if your opponent has like 12 mana. Like, There's plenty of other ways to do that besides Heart of Zadina.
So my thought process when making the card, and I described this a little bit in the last podcast episode, was based heavily on a lot of the fun I had casting Torment of Hailfire X equals, you know, 9-ish, and people just dying immediately because there's not much you can do when it's that big, especially once a control deck has run you out of resources. I think that games fundamentally need to end eventually, and there are so many different ways to beat Mastery of the Veil that I don't think the card is an issue unless you're hitting 12 mana way faster than you should. I've had games where my opponent has, you know, cast some life gain spells, and I've been like, oh, well, this changes my clock fundamentally. I need, you know, 3 more lands now to get a kill. And if you're ever playing that deck, especially decks where that's like your primary win con, against counter magic decks that aren't just all in on cursory glances, it feels rough. And that card's basically, yeah.
Disrupting their mana is pretty huge, too. Like, if you have a Will of the Fickle Lord, it's a lot harder to die to Veil. Hand attack,
I do agree,
harder to die to Veil.
I don't know if Whoops, You're Dead is kind of stupid. I'm also okay with Whoops, You're Dead's happening in the late game. The issue is they're definitely not. And I would point towards Heart of Zadina for that one. But I also get that, like, it doesn't really matter who the offender is. What matters is, oh, I just died out of nowhere.
Yeah, I think, like, I think the main offender is probably Heart. And I think it's less bad now that, you know, Intrepid has been nerfed. Obviously Jobai exists now, but, like,
I just think that
deck is fundamentally, like, the most unfun deck I've ever played against.
Sorry.
Like, canon or custom. I know that's a strong accusation, but I legitimately can't think of a game of Magic I've enjoyed less than playing against Heart Attack. What? Why would I ever want to do that?
We should play Canlander later. I have some decks to show you.
MSEM also does a very good job of curating. Like, if a deck is too unfun TM to play against, it usually gets taken out back. That's not an 100% rule, but I do think it's kind of notable that Heart Attack has survived for as long as it has, because, you know, both Mastery of the Veil... Oh, the other thing to keep in mind, when I was designing Mastery of the Veil, Heart of Zadina was not in the format. Mastery of the Veil and Heart of Zadina entered the format at the exact same moment, and I immediately got to work trying to Heart Attack people. And basically, we're like, you know, a year later or something crazy like that, and the deck is still identical. It runs less RFEs now, is basically a large portion of it. But I also think, like, if someone casts a Children's Clouds X equals 8 to 10, you're winning that game basically never.
And
I agree. It doesn't, like, there's a big difference between ending the game immediately, regardless of the board state, regardless of your own life total or what cards your opponent has on the board. And I also, okay, this is kind of random, but I really dislike how the other modes are basically just trinket text. Like, it just feels very aesthetically bad. Okay, I mean, you can be a Magic player and be like, well, actually, that, but
I've,
like,
seen a lot
90%
of the
time, like,
like, people.
If you cast that, you're going to lose that
for
game.
3 and 4 mana a ton and do interesting things. Like,
yeah, I was going to say, I think those people are kind of messing up. I mean, not super, because they have Whisperwood Exploration to rebuy it in the late game, but I think it's one of those things, like, it's much worse than Markarth Assailant at being
Markarth
a
Assailant's card that almost
that also life. Can kill people.
I disagree, because you can interact with Markarth, like, on the same axis.
An order of magnitude more fucked up than Mastery of the Veil, but I also think Mastery of the Veil does have some aesthetically displeasing parts of its design.
I sort of agree that it filling that role primarily is aesthetically displeasing, but I wouldn't go nearly as far as to say trinket text. I've seen a lot of good cheap masteries cast. I don't think it's a valuable resource the way you're implying, in part because of Whispered Woods, in part because you can just run two masteries.
Like, there's Mastery of the Veil is basically a split card. So there's the Edict mode because you're kind of fucked. There's the Edict and draw card mode because that's, you know, you have 4 mana. There's the 20 damage out of nowhere mode, / 16-ish is also usually enough. And there's also the I cast it, X equals 5, you no longer have a hand. I have seen that happen once, and I immediately regretted
it. I mean, that's just like Mind Shatter, right? And it is kind of silly that, like,
so
the
I
card
will
is
say,
basically
yeah,
Mind Shatter.
No, it's just a Mind Shatter.
Yeah.
Well, it's without the opportunity cost of mind shatter. Yeah. What I will say, I really fucking hated Mastery of the Veil on its own without heart when Intrepid was 3 mana. Because Mastery frequently killed right, at like X equals 5. Like, so much. Because, yeah, if you're against control, sometimes you really can't just deal with an Intrepid because you're trying to apply pressure. You're trying to get under this interaction and you don't have time to deal with this 4/4.
Yeah,
you're
like, I think
okay,
that's,
yeah,
that's
I can go to really 16, I can go to 12.
I think part of what increased my hatred for this combo was when I was watching Gateways play it on the other side in Team Unified Constructed, because before I was like, well, maybe this deck hard play, you know, maybe there are lines I'm missing, but no, it's just line up your ducks and shoot them all at once. Like, it's, I don't know.
I want the official stance of this podcast to just quickly be acknowledged. I never build control decks that are hard to play. That's not who I am. If you pick up one of the control decks that I've built or that like is an offshoot of something I've built, they're going to be things like, oh, herp to derp, I guess I cast my 2 mana draw 5 and then control the game. Huh, this game was easy. Or, oh, 12 mana, you're dead. Like, it's...
So, I've played a lot of Magic with Pip. I think over 2 years now, between some older custom formats, Myriad, MSEM, Highlander, and Real Magic. Pip never builds, like, genuinely skill-testing decks on purpose.
Yeah, Pup's the exception, actually.
And
I think compared to
Canon, that's not really skill testing though.
There's a
lot of decks that people think are skill testing, where you have so many lines and so many decision points, and no, you just do the thing. Apostate is such a dumb idiot deck. I could actually make a pod like
speaking of
flow
which
chart,
I have kind of a hot take. I don't know if I should just drop
reasonable.
It right now or save it for another podcast. Okay.
Your call.
I'll drop it, but I won't explain it because it might take too long. All right. I think Wonderfall is the hardest deck to pilot right. that currently exists in the format.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with that based on my 1-1 drop of a league run with it where I was like, well, this deck is broken looking. Like, Dodgers, you know, putting up insane results. I like these sorts of decks. This looks broken enough for me. And then just, like, it felt like trying to drive a car, but half of the steering wheel is, like, covered in tree sap.
I like to think I'm pretty good at piloting anything, and I have to agree.
Okay,
that deck is legitimately the most difficult to pilot MSEM deck.
All right, Simon, give us your number 2.
Yeah. Hardest Dina doesn't have shit on Nereva. Fuck Nereva. I almost put Monument here. Monument's fine, especially after the nerf. It's like a cute little man land that creates inevitability. You can stabilize sometimes, whatever. Fuck Nereva. It's like, especially with Heart, where you can just proc it, like, turn fucking 5, but absolutely just, I want Nereva to be... I want every copy of Nereva to be burned. Like, I hate what that does to control matches. It centralizes every game around it in control mirrors in a way that manlands can't, because manlands, you wait until you have the kill. Nereva, you just wait until you have 7 mana. That is like Incep, Nereva, untap, hold up another answer, or Nereva if they don't make you do anything, is a secret one card lock that people don't think is a lock. Like, Nereva is, if you have no cards in hand, Nereva is amazing. If you have a bunch of cards in hand, Nereva is even better because you have instants to back it up. Mirror Gate naming Nereva is my favorite turn one play in the format because it shuts off. Just mid-range and control decks that don't run Nereva should run Mirror Gate, period.
I'm going to co-sign all of that and also just say one of the things that I hate about playing Nereva is how often I've like started to do something and I've realized, wait, interacting with that is just straight up worse than drawing two cards. So I'm just going to sit on my hands and draw two more cards.
Wait, can I? Okay, so my pet peeve with Nereba is the fact that it says Wanderlust on it. Like, when has that ever mattered?
I've talked about this with Pipsqueak before. I constantly say I hate Nereba because yeah, it would like actually be more interesting of a card design if it had the opposite of Wanderlust.
It's just like I cannot even think of a but like yeah, that would be really neat,
right?
Where so part of Wanderlust would actually be relevant, and you are able to activate Nereba. You know, like it's just
so part of that is a vestigial part of the design. The original Nereba, which never made it to live, was three tap to draw a single card.
Yeah, that one's that one's pretty.
That is very much not okay. Because you would think, well, I mean, you know, four mana for one card versus seven mana for two cards. That sounds like a better way for those two cards. The speed at which you can start drawing extra cards, and you know, drawing extra cards is basically a win condition in control. If you're drawing three cards to your opponents, one, and you have the mana to use all three of those cards, it isn't actually possible to lose from that position. I'm also like starting to think, I think I have lost like maybe a tenth of the games I've played where I've activated Nereba. Just like it doesn't happen. And I mean, some of that's the survivorship, right?
Yeah. If you have the luxury of activating Nereba.
I did have one game where I managed to draw six lands off of Nereba and then die to someone's combo because I literally just did not see any interaction. But like, you know, easy come, easy go.
I also want to apologize to the listeners. I don't know if that was just too hateful and unfun of a rant because my bottom two cards that's the threshold of like actual vitriol.
And to our most devoted listener, dearest Matthew, the person who designed this card, you don't need to put a bullet in this card's head. I would have told you by now if you need to.
I think in terms of power level, there are enough tools to kill someone before they ever have the chance to activate it. It's just that when it does come online, it feels so hopeless.
So it induces those 95% games we were talking about right at the start of this podcast, where it's like you're basically dead. Although I do think it's,
I just hate the dynamic it introduces. I do think it's funny, slow matchups.
You cited that you hate it when games are 100%.
No, I'm okay with games being 100% over. I just don't like the game being over out of nowhere. Like, especially. Especially as quickly as those heart decks could pull it off.
You want it to be.
Like, I think it was very much like a total greater than some of the parts.
Yeah, I definitely think.
Yeah, and I think the Intrepid nerf helps that a lot.
Yeah. One other thing I want to briefly note, not that we've talked about win rates for any of these other cards, but because I was curious, if you remove me from the equation, Nereba has an exactly. Just technically 50% win rate. It's 181 matches out of 360.
I think that is an unfair selection, though, because
does it count like Nereba mirrors? Because isn't it one of like the most played cards? Yeah.
Decks that should be running Nereba. that's a good point. Mirrors probably mess with stat decks.
Off the top of my head, so
bit. That's because true. If a deck has an above 50% win rate, a mirror will always bring that win rate down. Mirror,
but I'm not certain.
I can only see that being an issue for like extremely played cards like Nereba.
At some point in the future, we should do an episode which is us just, you know, looking at shit on stat decks and talking about it.
I want to talk about my 69% win rate.
And talking about how it's not, it doesn't actually matter. Don't freak out.
Yeah, I learned that before this month I had a 69 percent win rate on Wayfarer Shrine, and now I'm really sad that I played games with Wayfarer Shrine this month. So I need to figure out what I'm doing about that. All right, so my number two hated card is something that has seen basically no play in this format. but it is a card that I've hated since its inception. Before it was in the format, when it was just someone's, like, one-off card idea, I hated it. And I have never stopped hating it, even after I shot it in the kneecap before it saw any, before it entered the format. And the card I'm talking about, of course, is Champion of Destinies. Champion of Destiny is one white for a 2/3 with vigilance and renown 1. And it says, when Champion of Destinies becomes renowned, you become the monarch. First thing of note, Champion of Destinies used to be a white card. That could come down on turn 2 in White Weenie without a single mana dork. It can still come down turn 2 in a green-white X deck. And the card is ludicrous. It creates these insanely binary game states where if your opponent doesn't play to the board, or if they're on the draw, or if their first creature happens to line up poorly into a 2/3 vigilance, they're done. They lose. Because if you have the monarch and a 3/4 vigilance to protect the monarch and to take it back whenever you like are starting to lose it, you basically can't lose from that position. And the number of push 3 drops that MSEM has that say, cool, the game is over, when they're played, if your opponent is only on one land when they're played, is already pretty high. And that card is just the most frustrating type of those card to play against, because Monarch creates those 95% games. It creates games where it's like, okay, well, my opponent's drawing 2 cards a turn while developing their board, while
playing so,
a set of creatures to protect them.
I actually kind of agree with you, because I've been playing Champion of Destinies in my latest league run. I've been playing like the Rafik deck, right? And the original build of the deck was I just wanted to do Hierarch Ranger into Rafik, right? And I was looking like, what's another good 3-drop that I can like curve into on turn 2?
Yep.
And honestly, I'd always been looking at Champion of Destinies, but I'd never like really found the shell where I thought it fit super well. But then I put it in this deck, right? And every single time I cast that thing on turn 2, I got to hit in, got the Monarch, and then I was like, cool, I'll just hold up mana, cast Cosmic Sinkhole on your stuff while I keep beating you up, and like there's basically nothing you can do while I draw a billion cards. So it is very much a remove this or lose creature. And when it comes down on turn 2, they often lose.
So I've never played with or against this card, given that I don't know the name. But Pipsqueak has talked to me about this card so much. I have about 1,000 hours of mental playtesting, which is something. And I played a lot with actual Monarch in Canlander, which is more where I'm coming from here. And actual Renown. I think that card is hot ass if you don't run one mana dorks. I think if you run one mana dorks, it suddenly becomes one of the best cards in the format. And I will go as far as to say as you should run it in every Lone Survivor deck. Because going Dovin into that card wins games. And
maybe. But 4 Dovin is also kind of sketchy.
I think the first mana dork is enough.
It depends. It depends. I could see it being correct.
It's on the 4th Divin, I guess. The thing I thought you were going to say, which you didn't, because you're a good player, it being a human is not an issue.
It's somewhat of an issue when you have a lone survivor, you don't need champion. You can't run any human in the lone champion, survivor. Like, sometimes I run Jade Vault Reclaimer, for instance, or some other stuff that, like, gives you enough bang for your buck. I think it could totally have a place in Survivor. I just generally think there are good options for 3-drops.
I do think vigilance is also a key part of why.
I was building it, but I ended up cutting it. Black White on Earth. Like, if you get that thing out on turn 1, like, that's even more gross, right? For sure. I mean, like, the main issue with Unearth potentially breaking the format is mostly buying with Karmaland, I think. I mean,
lying with Torment Lands, I'm actually just straight up saying, like, if you have to spend mana losing something,
largely agreed, yeah.
Unearth is fine.
But I have been considering putting it into Unearth, probably in the sideboard. if there's a lot of control.
In general, I also definitely have much more vitriol and hate in my body for Monarch cards post Commander Legends. But I think this card has always been something I've hated. As anyone the council can attest to, I was one of the two people who straight up when this card was selected off the bonus sheet, was like, this cannot be at two mana. If this is at two mana, we should.
Who is the other one? Are you allowed to say Egg? Of course it was Egg.
Egg.
Fucking Egg.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't let us have any fun.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Oh, okay. That felt like a cyber quip. Damn.
That was not a literal quote. To get that was better. Definitely what I was feeling. All right. So let's get to the most hated cards. And I would not be shocked if the vitriol stepped up one level, but also I hope that if the last round upset you, please know all three of us genuinely love this format. We love playing it, but you also don't sink as many hours as each of us have into this format without developing some cards that you just cannot stand. And this is very much coming from that place, also because this is kind of fun content in general. But if you weren't able to handle last round,
this is actually, I think my one pick might be a little surprising. It is a cycle, and it is a cycle of egg cards. And the reason I dislike them isn't because of how they play.
Ooh.
It's because not enough people play them. And it's very, very frustrating to me. And the answer, if you haven't figured it out, Kahembo mono fetches. I think these cards are absolutely kind of felt like obviously they were they could fetch untapped non-basics. And like I think people figured that out fairly quickly and fixed it. But they're still so good. Like they are so, so good in any deck that is less than three colors. Sometimes even in three color decks, if you're one base mana, or sorry, if you're like one base color, they just do so, so many different things. Wanderfall as a deck could not exist without the mono fetches. Like literally Wanderfall honestly started as like, hey, how can I abuse the mono fetches as much as possible? Just first off, being able to tap for mana without actually having to fetch means that it's so much easier to set up landfall triggers later. They fill your graveyard, right? So they in a two-color deck, they will often just cost you less life or the same amount of life as a a shock fetch. Because if you play them on turn one, say you want to play something on turn one, but maybe you don't want to cast something on turn two, this will cost you the same amount of life because you can just cast your one drop without, and then on turn two you can fetch a tapped non-basic. Or if you want to hold up mana, you can play it untapped, and then if your opponent doesn't, you don't end up needing the mana to cast a counterspell or whatever, you can fetch a tapped non-basic. I just think that like people don't, and then when people do play these cards, they never ever ever let them sit on the board. Like they always crack them immediately. And it's just so frustrating to me because I feel like there are so many very powerful play patterns that people can do. Sometimes you just want to leave, like, say you're playing Murky Pete, right? Just put a Corpse Bed in your deck. Like, just put a Corpse Bed in your deck, keep Murky Pete in play. Now your opponent has to play around you always having Corpse Bed available. Like, that is really, really powerful. If you're playing Tropical Grove, put a Sea Trine in your deck. Now your opponent has to play around you always having Sea Trine. I don't know. It just feels so insane to me that no one plays these cards.
I can't have a strong opinion on this because the vast majority of decks I've been playing lately are not decks that can or should run mono fetches really because they're three color and this one, there's formats where your mana is kind of better if you're three colors than two colors.
I don't think mono fetches are good in three colors anymore, by running mono fetches in a three color deck, but it
does get more painful.
So,
Oh, of course. And the other thing, I guess, is the two color decks I have been running.
See, I just think you're wrong.
Cannot accept like, that it, pain.
Because it's only painful if you decide that it's worth it. You can just pay one life and get a basic. Like, it's that one life is usually going to be negligible.
That when you're like a prison deck, the small amounts of life
but like add okay, up but a like lot. Just run more utility. You're
often
lands.
Stabilizing.
Like you get enough to value. Lock
someone out like on the wire, and necessary pay.
But you don't have, no, okay. The like, point is like you don't have to fetch the utility land
when you're trying to play on curve like you can, and lock someone out.
You're not going to play on curve every single game. Like your draws are not going to be perfect.
Okay, but you're so
okay. I want to hear. Being,
I want to provide a different perspective, which is, I think the mono fetches are part of the reason why you could play a five color deck and not even look at globe. And I think if you are playing a five color deck, the mono fetches are better than shock fetches. And part of the reason I'm
mean, five color definitely
slow three color decks and you know also four color decks. And part of the reason for that,
right? Yeah, those are also underplayed.
Hembo, Old Dawn, the fetchable Trilands. Those entering tapped means it was fine for you to have fetched them into play tapped, and being able to say, "Cool, I'm going to play a Murky Pete. I'm representing Exeunt through your entire first turn, and then if I don't need it, I now have a Triland." And that Triland only cost me one life, which doing that same exact line with a Shockland, representing a kill spell, and then getting a Triland instead, would have cost you two life to play on turf. So they're just less damage than Shock fetches if you want to represent something and you don't need to play on curve.
For clarity, when you say clarity to the listener, when you say you can cast Exeunt, you don't mean fetch a swamp. You mean pay the one life. So you can fetch a trot later when like, it's convenient.
Handy, like, well, I decided to run a bunch of pain lands or check lands, so I need a basic anyway, and I don't want to take two damage off of this Murky Pete. Sometimes you do just say, fine, I'll grab a basic swamp. And just the fact that you have all three of those decisions, do you take two damage to both add mana and then fetch a stronger non-basic later? Do you take one damage and get a tapped non-basic that fixes your mana for the rest of the game? Or do you take one mana and find a basic? Like, those are all three powerful options. And I think there's a chance that I am playing Wayfarer Shrine more than I should be.
I wouldn't say they've obsoleted Wayfarer Shrine because I think the most powerful way or like the most efficient way to build your mana base is to get two basics and then do all play lands. Right? Like, I think that's the most efficient way to build a four color mana base. And Wayfarer Shrine helps a lot with that. I don't know. That's maybe a separate conversation.
So, yeah, I guess, and like, you know, we did discuss having a different time where we talked about the intricacies of mana bases, but if Wayfarer Shrine does cost you a life, and if you know that your Murky Pete is going to 80% of the time, like, people play Wayfarer Shrines in, like, decks that are base one color all the time. Like, it's these
players. I mean, they already are, though, right? The like, they're already running
for any villainy deck should instead be on Murky Pete.
Am I not wrong? If they're not, they're trolling.
Then, yeah. I don't know.
Like, I don't know. It's just frustrating to me, not only how...
I feel like I've seen the most mono fetches, discounting the times I've seen Dodger play them, in decks that in the like three color decks I described where you just don't need them. I'm trying to think about times I've seen them in like the League and GBs,
it might just be a small sample size thing. How often do you want to?
I don't think they were putting
them on turn one. And how likely are they to be of the same color? Because, like, that situation Pip described is very real. Like if you are a deck that wants to cast either turn one Dark Bargain or turn one Exeunt a good portion of the time, like Murkypeat is probably going to be better than a lot of the Shock Fetch options because it just costs you less life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the next thing I guess I'll get into. You said
no, I think that they're very fun gameplay. I think they're very skill testing.
Do you hate the mono fetches themselves?
Like, I think that if the only situation where I would see them myself not liking the gameplay is if there are too many different targets to get with them. Like if there were multiple corpse bed level swamps to get, for instance, or like then it kind of becomes this weird web of like, oh, he's representing like four different lands because he's got two mono fetches in play, and it's like sort of hard to play into that. But like, I think as it is right now, there's a lot of potential. I don't know what to call it. Like, there's a lot of like easy points you can earn just by playing these cards well, and including them in decks that want them. And nobody's doing that, and it's very annoying to me. Well, it's not about
imagine how painful it is just watching people not.
I mean, play okay, yes, essentially, but also then people who do play them wrong, like they just always fetch for basic immediately most of the time.
Okay. So when I'm looking at my deck list or someone else's, I always ask, is this the mono fetch deck?
If it gets people to play more mono fetches, I'm gonna literally start anyone can ping me at any time and ask me if it's a mono fetch deck.
All right, Simon.
I will not get mad. Anyone.
All right, gonna set an alarm for 5 a.m.
Yeah, no, I'm serious.
Simon, what is your most hated card in the format?
So first I want to say I'm a big fan of Fluffy Deathbringer. I really like what they have brought to any community I've seen them in. I MSEM, MSE, CM when they're on CM. Fuck Baham. Actually, Cajun design, because I'm talking about green-white Baham. Baham is Satan. Like, all of the cards I've talked about, I've played with all, but Impumo I've played against. And I gotta say, Baham is the only one where I have thoroughly never enjoyed ever. Nereba has done neat things. Baham has not. Baham does not know joy or happiness. Baham only knows being three different whack-ass silver bullet cards. So he's amazing against burn any artifact deck, random combo decks, graveyard decks, and fucking control decks, because he can just blow up their non-basics or gain a bunch of life and tick for his ult. The only decks that Baham are bad against are really creature-heavy decks that don't run burn. And it's still good against those decks, because those decks run non-basics. Baham is just pure concentrated, powerful text without doing anything cool. Baham makes me appreciate Oko, because at least Oko
randomly agree with you
people and does fun things.
I think even in the creature deck situation that you just described, this is kind of a similar thing to Oko, right? Like when I first saw Oko, Humblebrag, I actually was like, oh, this is going to dominate Standard. I didn't go so far as to say, other formats. But like, I showed this to my friend, and I was like, against aggro, this literally just says, like, gain 8 life, right? Like, that's the base case for Oko, right? Or, like, whatever number, like, a lot of life. Actually, it's 9, right? Because he goes up to 6 and you gain 3 from the food. Yeah, so, like, Baham, in that situation, it's just gain 8 life.
Yep.
Right? Because it's 5 loyalty and you gain 3 life. And they can't afford to let Baham sit and play. Right? So, like, it kind of has the same energy to me. Or when you play it, it's just like Like, you get this played against you, and it's just like, oh, like, it doesn't feel like it should be good, but it is. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yes. That is about literally every matchup.
I remember at one point in time, I don't remember, I've told this anecdote before, but I don't remember exactly the circumstances. Cyber and I were chatting in person, and we were like, we were talking about a couple of different decks we were considering bringing to the next GP. But at that point in time, Augur had just been grinding out games as Leyline, Alignment Field, Angel Touched. And the newest card, the newest bit of tech that that deck had was Bahum. And we basically came to the conclusion that none of the decks that we could think of that seemed good were good against Bahum. It's like, all right, well, Bahum exiles Villainy, exiles Ninasir, exiles any non-basic land out of control, is a must-answer threat versus control. If we're playing aggro, it can't be burn. We shouldn't be on a graveyard-based deck that's doing Hunter's Hideout things. Also exiles Hunter's Hideout. And just we went down this list, and we're like, okay, I think our plan is just hope she never draws Bahum, because I don't think we can beat that card. And I think it's one of those things where it's like, it's so weird to... I don't think Bahum is the most powerful walker in this format, but I think Bahum is the walker with, like, the best fail case, and is probably punching in, like, the top 10, top 5.
Like, there are just so many matchups where Bahum feels like you sided in Leyline of the Void against, yeah, like, Dredge before it had good enchantment kill. But you mainboard it because its worst matchup is still fine. But there are just so many matchups where it automatically wins, essentially. If I just read off matchups where Bahum is fucking absurd, I would just be reading the format. I would be reading a majority of the format, yeah, in a surprising amount of aggro decks people play. And again, the biggest thing, ask yourself, has Bahum have you ever drawn or cast Bahum and gone, this game is more interesting and compelling now? I would play more magic because of this card. No, never. Absolutely not. If you think so, you are lying.
That's so egregious about Bahum is the number of circumstances where they feel like they shouldn't be good, and then they are. Like, you're like, oh, cool. I'm against this, like, maybe not full-on aggro deck, but something lower to the ground than me. And I'm on the play, and I'm on control, and I just drew Bahum. So I'm going to send them back to their turn 2. So they're now untapping into their turn 3 rather than their turn 4. And if they had a plan built around doing anything with that fourth mana, they're done. If they don't have another land to play, cool, they're down to 2 lands, and the next turn I'll take them down to 1 land. And most decks can't afford to aggressively fetch basics. Like, throughout this podcast, we've talked a lot about, oh, you just fetch a non-basic, or, oh, this color's free splash and stuff. It's like, you can fetch basics, but you'll only get punished in very small circumstances. It's not like there's a Blood Moon lurking around the corner in every matchup. It's just every so often someone has Imperial Siege, or someone has 2 Imperial Sieges stapled to a walker.
Wait,
so Pip, what I'm hearing is Splash Bahum and Ponzu.
Deletes your opponent's graveyard, deletes their artifacts, enchantments, and non-basic lands.
Yeah.
I think
there are no, I mean, it actually sounds pretty good.
Unironically.
Yeah.
No, but it covers lot of combo matchups and, like, that I imagine Ponzu sometimes struggles with.
So, you know. Bye-bye, standing token. All right. So to wrap up this Knight of Excessive Vitriol, we will have a card that I think I have hated. It is the card that I've hated the longest in my MSCM career, because the only other cards that competed have, like, all faded into the background slash been hit already. But this is a card that isn't quite good enough to justify nerfing and isn't played enough for the miserable game experience to come up, but I genuinely think it is one of the most frustrating cards to play against an MSAM. And I am, of course, talking about Disseminate. If you're not familiar with Disseminate, God, I wish I was you. For one white, it's an instant with exile target creature unless its controller pays one. So, okay, if you're playing on curve, it's one white, exile something. That's, like, kind of rough, but also it's like there's a big if there. It's if you're playing on curve. It's better than Force Spike, but also, like, you know, whatever. Except that's not where the card text ends, because it also has flashback two in a white. And you know what? Instant speed flashback on a card that specifically is attack spell just leads to the most frustrating gameplay moments, where you blank for a second and you forget and you throw a creature into it that you did not need to throw into it. And you spend the rest of the game thinking, I should just wait for one more land. Or the opposite circumstance. You're sitting there afraid of it being used, where you really need to just plow through it, because as long as it's in there, it's effectively stone raining you. You have one fewer land to do anything with, and you just really need to bite the bullet. And you have not experienced true pain until you have had someone flashback into somebody. You pay for it.
Yeah, okay, well, I have run this card in two different decks. I have to agree with you. It is so good. Like,
I'm going to do something I don't often do. I'm going to make a case for Force Spike. Now, Force Spike plays well, and cards like Force Spike play well, because when you're casting a spell, you are paying mana. That is when you tap lands, and that is how you can sequence the order in which you cast spells such that you have some extra up, and that creates really interesting lines of play. You can bluff it. You get a lot of fun out of that. Because, again, it's a small window that Force Spike hits, specifically when you already have mana up anyway, because you're casting a spell. Disseminate doesn't. It's just, its window has literally any creature. So you're always asked when playing around it to have up one mana. And you're like, okay, at least it just happens once. You can treat it like a path variant. Because I'm only asked to always have up one mana. No! No, it has to play worse. It has to be an onboard trick. From the graveyard.
The other thing that I just kind of despise about it is one of those cards that's in the perfect, like, V of, it is so ridiculously good, but the fail case of it is so stunningly mediocre that I can't justify running it. And, you know, I like to play these hyper late game control decks, and if my removal spell turns off after turn 5-6, that's a problem. And so Disseminate is one of those cards where it's a card that is ridiculously good.
It's it.
Until your opponent has their mana under them, at which case it turns off. It is not a card. You don't need... Like, you still sometimes get people, but those moments become few and far between, and it mostly just is a headache for both players. It's a headache for your opponent to play around it, but also...
So two points. Like, one is insane in tempo, obviously.
Let me do this. And that happens.
I was about
the fact that it's so little played means that no one plays around it. So when you do get hit by it, it feels even worse. Because just like, man, like it almost feels like a cheese card. Even though it isn't. Like, it's a good card, but it just feels like, oh man, like he's really playing that card. Like, come on. You know what I mean? Like,
fundamentally, yeah. Fundamentally, Disseminate is the emotional equivalent of stubbing your toe on an object you thought moved out of the way. And then you, like, groan, like, you know, you've gone out of bed, you're slightly groggy, you're going to, like, get water in the middle of the night, you stub your toe. You're like, fuck. And you, like, shift the, like, stool off to the side or whatever. And then you're coming back to lie down in your bed, all you want to do is go to sleep, and you stub your fucking toe again on the same fucking stool. That's what playing gets Disseminate every single time.
I just think it's, like, a confluence of so many different design mistakes in a way that amplify each other.
Yep.
I also think it makes the format look a little bit worse in a way that none of the other cards we mentioned did. Disseminate was legitimately one of the reasons I looked down on MSEM for a while.
Yeah. All right. That is our evening. I hope everyone enjoyed it. If this is the sort of content you like, please let us know. If this is the sort of content you think we should never, ever do again, also definitely let us know that. I don't think this would ever become a regular thing, but I definitely had fun talking about a lot of these cards and like analyzing some of the design mistakes inherent in very playable cards. And also just, you know, some of these things are not things I would have thought of. So,
oh, if I could say one thing,
but yeah,
I think as a designer, it's better for someone to have a strong opinion on your thing, even if that thing is negative, than for them to have no opinion at all. I think like, I think that
I don't.
I think it depends on why. If it's because you were trying something ambitious, sure. I think if you do something like, not that anyone would do this, just keyword adding a disseminate to your hand. I don't think that's a good kind of polarizing. I think that's just like,
I don't want to use the word trolling, but like, there's a difference between like making an active design attempt and making something that's specifically bad to be bad.
No, like, making something
like, all these polarizing cards were design attempts. Right?
Like, has a small audience.
It's okay that some people hate them. Like, some people are going to hate everything that you do. You know, like, and that this is just like, at the end of the day, we're like three people. You know, so
yeah.
Just suddenly.
And honestly, I enjoy playing with Disseminate a lot because I think it rewards knowing when it's the right time to put it in the deck. But it is one of the more frustrating cards to play against, and I can't deny that.
The other just kind of general thing to consider here is Morrow had that saying about like, you know, it's much better to have that exact same polarizing thing. But I think a very important thing to consider as a designer is making sure that your cards aren't just hated. Making sure you need to hope that there is maybe not an equal amount, but a large number of people who love any card that you created that other people hate. Because if you just made a card that angers everyone, such as, I don't know, you decide to print Black Lotus at Mythic in a random product, then you do deserve all of the hate you get. Every last bit of it. And no, you did not try anything. Go fuck yourself.
You...
they can't listen to this because that would be...
I feel like I just dodged a bullet there. I do want to say, like, if 1,000 people did this podcast, I do feel like 900 of those times, Vibrant Rapture would probably make this list. And that's the card I
hate. That's probably fair.
You see, to Dodger, to Matt, to the other Matt, both Matts hate it. To Akko,
I didn't put it on this.
All of y'all are wrong. That card is sick as fuck. And
the only reason you considered it was because of the X equals zero case, which I think is
you're on the list now. but yeah, like, and that's not a card I would consider removing from the set for a minute, and that's not a card that I think makes the set worse, despite the fact that I know 901 people out of 1,000 would have put this on their top four.
I was about to just brag, like, you know, at least I don't make cards people hate.
Your card was also the inspiration for this podcast.
During this podcast, so I guess that's an L for me then. Yeah, that's.
I know for a fact Lone Survivor would also be on some people's lists.
I actually don't think Lone Survivor is very good at all.
Lone Survivor on their list needs to play a fucking game of Magic.
I'm not saying that Lone Survivor. I don't hate that card at all. I have nothing but neutral feelings towards that lonely boy. He doesn't evoke emotion out of me, but a lot of people hate him.
I'm just glad we are not living in the timeline where someone could curve Fog Spearer into Survivor into Summit Guardian. I'm overwhelmingly
glad. I want my free wins.
You're sad. Are you sure?
Doctor.
Oh, you can say you hate your cards whenever
some
you,
so
you
can say you hate my cards. So I can say that I hate your cards next time.
Oof. All right. Well, if you want my set to FNCM,
I don't know your cards.
This is a good reminder to everyone to go out and vote. And thankfully, that's no longer referring to our lives, but instead, just vote for what set you think should be added to MSEM, because we're doing that right now for some reason.
Thank you for having me.
I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you two for joining us.
Yeah.
Joining me. And I'm